Eva, come in.
On BBC Radio 4.
We rarely get away, do we?
No.
Kirk.
Yes.
Let me take your coat.
Oh, thank you very much.
Joan Bakewell, David Baddiel and Sophie Ellis-Bextor host their dream dinner party.
Hopefully there's something for everyone.
That's right.
That I love.
With extraordinary guests brought back to life thanks to the BBC Archive.
Oh, you've got to laugh, haven't you, when you say that?
My Dream Dinner Party.
Give me a nice big plate of fettuccine.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting this Saturday morning at 10:30.
And starting now on Radio 4 Extra, it's Great Lives, focusing on the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams. Here on Radio 4, it's Big Problems with Helen Keane, who's been researching food so you don't have to.
The scene, our world. The time, now. Natural resources are dwindling. Earth's population is increasing. There are now over 7 billion people on Earth, and a small group of very nervous cod. How do we feed everyone? There are so many people and not enough food. It's like my friend's wedding all over again. By 2050, there will be 9 billion people, and by 2050, I mean 10 to 9 tonight. Can we continue to treat planet Earth just like a Pizza Hut salad bar, where the distribution of resources is wholly unfair? Most of the good stuff is already gone. And the greediest just don't care how hungry everyone else is. Also, did someone just cough on the coleslaw? But let us rally our technology and engineering, our sciences and our arts, to defeat the forces of unprogress. Yes, this is the game changer. It's Big Problems with Helen Keane!
I'm Helen Keane, and joining me to thrill and terrify with tales of our possible future, please welcome the voice of doom.
Hello.
And the voice of gloom.
Hi.
So yes, welcome to our problem-probing extravaganza. Today's conundrum.
How can we make sure everyone is fed? By 2050, the world's population is predicted to grow to a total of at least 9 billion. Allowing for wars, famines, epidemics, and Channel 4 announcing another series of The Jump.
That's going to put an even greater strain on the Earth's precious food supply. Obviously, this leads us to a huge question, something that we will all of us be asking. All humanity, and indeed all organisms, have asked themselves this in one guise or another throughout history since the dawn of time. What am I going to have for my tea?
Or what am I going to have for my supper if you're posh? Or what am I going to have for my dinner if you're scum?
So,
solution one, check the back of the cupboard.
Four tiny jars of paprika. If I find my cupboard is bare and I need to go to the shops, I might ask, well, what did I have yesterday or last year? What's in this Tupperware in the freezer? And was it here when I moved into the flat? What do other people have for their tea? How can I find that out? Is all this questioning making me more hungry?
As it turns out, in the UK, the Office of National Statistics keeps quite a close eye on this for the typical person. Since 1947, they've measured inflation via a basket of goods and services that reflects an average shopping basket of a typical household in this country. The items included are updated to follow the public's tastes, so we have a record of how shopping habits, the way we purchase and consume food, have altered over time.
For instance, in 1947, in the heady months just after World War II, the typical basket included
corned beef, condensed milk, wild rabbit.
Whereas by 2017, in less certain, perhaps less optimistic times of change, the contents being assessed from the typical basket had changed considerably.
Non-dairy milk, cycling helmet, gin. Gin!
That's a huge change over the course of just a couple of generations.
Gin!
And of course, there doesn't seem to be much in the way of food that's been added to the new basket in 2017.
Daddy, I'm hungry. What did you get
from the supermarket today?
I got the standard basket of goods, darling. Some almond milk, a cycle helmet, and this delicious gin.
But, Daddy, what can I have for my dinner or tea if we were from the north? I want to grow up big and strong and sufficiently nourished.
Now, I'm only buying these things to take care of you. The cycle helmet will stop you hurting your head if you fall off your bike. Juniper is probably one of your five a day. And I bought the almond milk especially as we're middle class, so I've decided we're probably all lactose intolerant.
Oh, can I cycle round to Grandma's house? She's still using the 1977 basket of goods, so I can have corned beef and smash and a Watney's Party 7.
A tin of corned beef was a staple of British shopping baskets from 1947 to 2005.
It had that little windy key way of opening the tin, didn't it? Like you were unveiling a treasure rather than a solid brick of cow.
A few years ago, I was at a funeral in Yorkshire when afterwards the talk turned to misunderstandings. One of my aunties nudged her husband and said, "Oh, do you remember when you thought I'd put broken glass in your dinner?" "Well," he said, "I'd never seen sea salt before." But condiments aside, we've never, ever had more choice about the kind of food we can eat. The ONS basket of goods tells us what we are buying and presumably eating, although maybe not.
People in the UK throw away 7 million tonnes of food every year. And according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, one third of global food production is lost or wasted annually.
That's an enormous amount of food just thrown away. 7 million tonnes is about a million elephants, or 3.5 trillion Lego bricks, or nearly 18 million take-thats. That's in their heyday, pedants. They've lost a fair bit of weight since then. So maybe I could have some leftovers for my tea, or look at the ONS basket of goods to see what everyone else is having.
Gin!
Solution number two is...
eating naturally. Get out of my garden.
What's the best diet for us? What is the natural way to eat?
A biologist studying the behaviour of animals would say perhaps what's truly natural is for all the individuals of a particular species to eat the same food as the rest of the group eats. But you may not want to mention this next time you have dinner guests who are paleo-alkalizing pescatarians.
If we look to nature, we'll see that, for instance, these wild bees... all eat nectar. It would be super weird and unnatural if one bee suddenly decided she was going to go low-carb ketogenic and so drops the carbs and starts trying to eat protein-rich other bees.
Though no one would be surprised at all if that was a wasp.
Debate about what's a natural diet.
Some believe raw food is more natural than cooked food for us humans, while we've discovered in recent years that other animals, such as chimps, use tools.
We're still the only animal who cooks, though, thank God. Otherwise, natural history documentaries would be incredibly tedious.
And here we see that the leopards work as a team. Four chase down the wildebeest, one starts up the barbecue. And has to quickly nip back to the shops because he forgot to bring the bread rolls.
And this is important. There's a theory that when humans started cooking, that's when civilization took off. All the extra nutrients humans could suddenly access from better, more easily digestible cooked food helped our brains to grow bigger.
OMG, I'm on this amazing diet. You've got to try it. You only eat cooked food. I've put on 15 pounds, but I've gained 25 IQ points.
Look at your super flat stomach.
That's because I've got a copy of A Brief History of Time tucked into my trousers.
Solution three, eat superfoods.
If we also start looking to the answers we can get from science, we should say, from the outset, there aren't really any magic foods. Well, beetroot changes the colour of your wee, and sugar puffs make it smell of sugar puffs. But I don't mean that kind of magic. Foods that have highly specific positive effects, superfoods, if you will, those...
This one food can melt belly fat!
clickbait tricks that just pop up when you're online. Spoiler, nothing just melts belly fat. The popular idea that we have some foods that are magic or powerful may in part be due to us being more and more removed from the mysteries of food cultivation and production.
In the West, we consume more food than ever before, yet we know much less about it. According to a recent headline in The Telegraph, 1 in 8 young people have never seen a cow in real life. But if you want embarrassing statistics, 1 in 8 Telegraph readers have never seen the Algarve.
But yes, the nearest we get to a magic, super healthy diet that seems to work in terms of getting us living longer and healthier lives is the Mediterranean diet.
Its basis is a lot of vegetables and olive oil. Seem to work all right for Popeye. Tom Sanders, an emeritus professor of nutrition and diet at King's College London, says the Mediterranean diet emphasizes values of hospitality, neighborliness, intercultural dialogue, and creativity, and a way of life guided by respect for diversity.
It's sort of the opposite of Greg's.
Quite simply, this is really the only diet that has been studied long enough for nutritionists and scientists to widely recommend it. It's possible there are other diets that also have health benefits. For instance, it seems some spices used in Indian cuisine or fermented soy products from Japanese kitchens may have health benefits, and they're currently being studied for that reason.
And, yes, science, when are you going to ask me about my writing this show diet involving a neatly packeted air-puffed cheesy snack? The mark of its tasty success is that it leaves the chin covered in a layer of satisfyingly day-glow orange dust, plus a similar finger residue which adds a lurid soupçon of sunset-hued danger to typing on a laptop you can ill afford to replace. If you love a woman, never watch her eat, said Samuel Johnson, and he'd never even met me.
Though we know, for instance, that it's generally not good for us to cover absolutely everything we eat with a thick layer of refined sugar. In fact, if Scarface had been snorting a big mountain of Tate and Lyle instead of cocaine off that table, it looks like things would have been just as bad. But naturally occurring sugar is in so many foods in their basic, natural state. Some scientists believe that a taste for sweet things was discovered hundreds of millions of years ago by primordial life, and we've loved it ever since.
All those years ago, the discovery of the deliciousness of sweet things may have gone something like this.
What are you doing?
I'm eating. I'm digesting something from outside into my inside.
You seem really happy, though. Delighted. Even though complex emotions and their recognition are many millennia off in evolutionary terms. Are you eating something that's particularly eatable?
No.
Can I have some?
Oh, it's actually... You wouldn't like it at all. It's actually sort of horrible. And oh dear, it's gone.
In olden times, when you didn't have a Tesco Express at the end of the street, being attracted to a good source of readily available energy, like fruit, would be advantageous. So a sweet tooth was massively helpful. Now, when sweets and chocolates and caramel popcorn cream frappuccinos are everywhere, that sweet tooth has... probably rotted a bit.
Solution 4. It's all a matter of taste.
A really big thing for us humans in deciding what to eat is, do we like how it tastes? The good Mediterranean diet we just heard about famously includes the odd glass or two of wine. Wine, in moderation, is probably, and this goes backwards and forwards a bit in the research literature, pretty good for you. And humans are pretty keen on wine, always have been. In the 1200s, the poet, jurist, Islamic scholar, theologian, and Sufi mystic Rumi said,
"Either give me more wine or leave me alone."
500 years later, and wine was still going strong. American founding father and polymath Benjamin Franklin was super into it. He said,
"In wine there is wisdom. In beer, there is freedom. You would not believe how much freedom there is in beer. There's so much freedom. In water, there is bacteria. We are going to drive them out. The discovery of a wine is of greater moment than the discovery of a constellation. The universe is too full of stars. There are loads of those glittery bastards there everywhere. Terrible, sad."
make a confession. For a really long time, I didn't like the taste of wine, any wine. I do realise it comes in different colours.
There's just like the faintest soup sign of like asparagus and just a flutter of tristesse, a dim echo of a disappointing afternoon in the nursery. Also possibly nutty Edam cheese.
Yeah. Wine drinkers love their wine to taste of other stuff. Cheesy, asparagusy, sour, grapey stuff. But this doesn't hold for any other taste experiences.
It's not good when you eat a beef burger and get a flutter of horse.
There does seem to be a slight difference in the number of taste buds people of different ethnic backgrounds and sexes have. And guess what? White men have the fewest taste buds. Though I guess we already knew this if you look at the success of, say, Nickelback.
But surely that should mean that in the UK we eat more flavourful food. Well, earlier in our European history, it seems people did cook with a greater range of herbs and spices and flavours than we might expect. It's just that later, when spices became more plentiful and available to all, they fell out of favour as fashionable.
Yeah, I was really into fenugreek when it first came out, but now everyone's using it. I just think it's really sold out.
Yeah, totally. I mean, some people I know are using, like, dried lemongrass, but it's so much better live. So now I'm using juniper berries because people don't really think of them as a spice, but they totally are, you know?
Did you say juniper? Like, gin?
So it's a long and winding road through cultural and religious and class changes that leads to us in the UK enjoying covering meat in a sauce of, well, more meat, a.k.a. gravy.
Gravy doesn't sound as appetising if you describe it more accurately. Hot meat sweat. Or in Scotland, the Scotch egg. A gourmet variation recipe I saw for this basically described an egg wrapped in chicken mince, i.e. the ground-up meat of a dead parent coating the never-to-be-realised potential of its pitifully young child. And the atrocity is masked by breadcrumbs, giving it a flutter of Hansel and Gretel in the dark. Yes, actually, I am a vegetarian.
But what actually happens when we taste things?
Well, it's a process by which your tongue reads the chemicals in the food. This is why if, for instance, you hear a friend talking about the idea of pursuing a chemical-free diet, it's unlikely. The chemicals naturally present in food are how we're actually tasting it and telling that it's food.
The old idea that different areas of your tongue taste different things that some of us learned at school is wrong. Other things you learned in school that are now wrong include Pluto being a planet, mice like cheese, and George W. Bush being America's stupidest ever president. Taste buds are on the human tongue in structures called papillae, and fungiform papillae, the ones on the front of the tongue, if you magnify them, they look like little button mushrooms. And super tasters have many, many more of these than average.
Stand aside. This is a job for Super Taster.
Super Taster? But surely as a white man, your taste buds aren't all that great. Shouldn't Super Taster be a woman of colour?
That's not how the superheroes thing works. Now step aside, civilian, and let me work.
Oh, stop licking everything. It's so unhygienic.
I am not licking everything. I am unleashing my super tasting powers.
How is that going to save the children from the burning orphanage?
A burning orphanage, you say?
Yes.
Not a barbecue?
No.
Stand aside. This is not a job for a super taster. Solution 3. Eat the food of the future.
We don't mean live on seeds, which will literally be food in the future. Though I'm aware that some people do live on seeds with greater or lesser success. The successful ones are called birds. The unsuccessful ones are called hippies or liberal Democrats. No. There is an exploding market in artificial foods.
So the boffins were right. We will have a meal in a tablet.
Which boffins were those then?
Oh, you know,
boffins working at NASA and Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Staple meal replacement Soylent was invented and marketed as a product in 2014 after being invented in a slightly different way in the science fiction of the 1970s.
Please note, during its recent development, it was only the funding that came from crowds rather than the source material.
Soylent is an incredibly bad name for a meal replacement product, isn't it? Naming after a fictional movie foodstuff with sinister origins. It's like if astronomers discovered a new world in our solar system and called it Planet of the Apes. It's just asking for trouble. Or starting a new hotel chain called Bates Motel. I'm not convinced Soylent and products like it are going to take off. Having caused gastrointestinal problems and having a taste described as
homemade non-toxic Play-Doh.
And an appearance likened to
watered-down semen.
Scientists and businesses are trying to grow their own meat. And I don't mean leaving half a pepperami under your bed for 6 months and seeing what happens. If we get to a stage where we're growing our own meat in a lab, perhaps you'll no longer be told the provenance of the meat itself, but rather of the scientist who grew it.
What would you recommend?
We've either got the chicken grown by Clive, who's got a massive garden and plenty of room to roam about in, or the Wagyu steak, genetically engineered by Anne, whose husband massages and rubs beer into her every day.
Do you have Anne's husband's number?
Understandably, when we hear about radical changes to food, new ways of growing and producing it, so-called frankenfoods, we can get anxious. Frankenfood obviously derives from that awful composite of myriad different body parts, the frankenfurter.
Do you have the final parts, Igor?
Yes, Master. I salvaged a bun from the bins outside McDonald's.
At last, my creation is complete. I have defied nature and created a delicious burger from spare parts and bits I found lying around. And now to make my creation a companion.
Do you want fries with that?
The more you look into the history of food, the more you realise that even the most natural organic fruits you can buy in Whole Foods Market for $17.50 per microounce are the result of centuries of selective breeding and modifications. Sure, the pace of food change has certainly quickened with genetic modification and gene editing technology. But if you Google oil paintings of food, for instance, watermelons from 300 years ago, something you'll notice. Everything is smaller, less colourful, more, well, unappetising looking. It's like those before they were famous shots of the cast of Towie.
But should we be concerned with how our pollution is affecting the animals and plants we eat in unnatural ways? A recent study of salmon caught near Seattle in the United States found they were contaminated with cocaine, antidepressants, and painkillers, and are now being offered high-paid brokering jobs at the New York Stock Exchange.
You realise we might be overfishing when now the salmon are on antidepressants.
Solution 4. Maybe the future is already here, in the air, all around us.
In 2013, the UN released a report addressing the huge problem of world hunger. One of their major recommendations is that we start putting insects on the menu.
Insects deliver efficient calories. They provide protein in a form that's easy for our bodies to use and use a smaller quantity of resources to raise them pound for pound compared to, for example, beef. This is known as a low footprint. Not a good phrase that makes you think of their tiny feet, their many feet, they are crawling everywhere, they're in my hair.
Our ancestors would have cheerfully eaten insects without thinking too much about it. We still do. Insects get everywhere, so they're bound to be in our processed food, just not listed on the ingredients. And if you think it's disgusting because you don't quite know what's going in your mouth, but have ever bought a sausage in a bun outside a tube station on an autumn evening, you may need to take yourself to one side and have a word. If we ate insects, it could revolutionise the farming industry.
Now, for crying out loud, this place is a tip.
No, it's not a mess. It's a farm.
What?
That may look like a pile of dirty old clothes, but I'm actually raising my own herd of organic moths. Oh, delicious.
And that pile of dirty plates there, that's where I harvest my flies.
And this leftover ham sandwich down the back of the sofa?
Yeah, I'm trying to crack the hipster hand-reared maggot market.
As it's recommended by the UN, we thought we would get you, our lovely audience, to try some insects. Response is phenomenal. So if I could just have the lights up. Who here tonight is a meat eater? Please raise your hand. Oh, quite a few people. And are any of you on high protein diets? Because insects are very, very high in protein, so anyone particularly keen to get some of that proteiny, crawly goodness? What have you got? The locust.
Locust.
And what are you called, locust eater?
Adam.
Adam.
Oh, there's another one.
It's a locust at low cost.
Oh, ready? Brilliant. It's picking up. It's picking up. Ready, Adam? Yep.
They're quite good, yeah.
They started eating the flaming lot.
Yes. That too.
Would anyone else? Like, Adam, you could pass them down your row. Take one of them. Try it. Just show. No, get one of the big cockroachy ones. No.
These insects are very dead. It's not like when Freddie Starr threw maggots into
fresh,
the audience.
But fresh. Dead, but freshly dead. What's your name?
Miranda.
Miranda. What are you having, Miranda?
Another one of these. Locust. Yeah, locust.
Another locust.
Yes.
Yes, brilliant.
It might be. Oh.
That was fresh.
Not very juicy, thank you.
Not very juicy. would you have them again?
I'd have them in a crepe with some cheese.
Good! Having witnessed the reaction of your fellow audience, is anyone now more tempted?
No.
No. Isn't it obvious? You know, obvious. Someone else is just getting one there. What are you making of that?
Tina.
Tina, what are you thinking of that, Tina?
Am I gonna die?
Well, we'll check back at the end of the show. I might not have bugs for my tea tonight. They're not that readily available yet, though I suppose I could just keep my mouth open as I cycle home and see how full I feel after that. In worrying about what we're doing to ourselves when we eat, we're not worrying about what we're doing to the other people and animals and the whole of our environment. At the moment, the best way of taking care of this looks like science. If we really want to feed everyone, then genetically modifying food crops to make them higher yield and more disease resistance is, right now, the best hope we've got. And maybe we need to just relax about it all a bit. How about a fad diet that makes the world a better, more sustainable place?
I'm on this amazing new diet.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I've lost half a ton of carbon already.
So, what will I have for my tea? Well, maybe a Mediterranean-style tapas with a side of gravy over vegan scotch egg with miniature sugar-reduced mosquito burger. But whatever, healthy choices mean healthy for everyone. As the Cree prophecy says,
only when the last tree has been cut down, the last fish been caught, and the last stream poisoned, will we realise we cannot eat money.
Oh, what about those chocolate coins you get at Christmas?
Listening and good night.
Big Problems with Helen Keane was written by Helen Keane, Jenny LaVille, Lloyd Langford and Kerry Quinlan, with special thanks to Laura Alexandra Smith. It was performed by Helen Keane, John Coulshaw and Susie Kay. The producer was Katie Tyrrell, and it was a BBC